On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk about antitrust probes into Google. Curtis talks about crowdsourcing security. Plus, Cheever brings us home with VPN vulnerabilities and trust. You can't ask for better topics. Join us for this and more. Twyte on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyte, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 360, recorded September 20th, 2019. Don't turn off your brain. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by DigitalOcean. Deploy and scale your apps seamlessly on the simplest cloud platform. Join over 150,000 businesses that use DigitalOcean. Sign up today and receive a free $50 credit at do.co/twit. And by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology's advanced technology center is like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million of equipment, including OEMs like NetApp, and it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all that it offers, go to wwt.com/twit. And by LastPass, a personal password manager and identity solution for businesses all in one. You only need one master password, and LastPass remembers the rest. Visit LastPass.com/twit to learn more. Welcome to Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I definitely don't want to guide you by myself. I want to bring in the experts, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, great to see you, man. Welcome back.
It is great to be here. Always happy to be with Twit on a Friday afternoon. And this weekend, I'm not planning to head into a couple of sleepless days like I was last weekend. I tell you what, that hackathon was fun and productive, and my team won. But I'm hitting the point where I really do need my beauty rest.
I understand that for sure. Well, speaking of beauty rest, we have our very own geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, how you been doing down there in paradise?
I'm better, thank you. My rib only hurts if I do a really big cough. So, as Loquacious and other folks are saying, don't do a big cough. But anyway, yeah, I'm also getting ready and putting my kit together because I will be heading to Wispapalooza next month in Las Vegas at the Rio, which is going to be really interesting. See what is happening for the wireless internet service providers of the world.
Fantastic. Well, folks, we have a pretty great show. We're going to talk a little bit about internet service providers as well. We're not going to talk about a little bit about Google, and maybe there might be actually a target for some things going on around town, as well as we're going to talk a little bit about VPN and crowdsourcing security. But before we get into all that goodness, let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Well, you remember Edward Snowden. Well, he was that IT systems expert who worked under contract for the National Security Agency, and then he traveled to Hong Kong to provide three journalists with thousands of top secret documents about U.S. intelligence agencies actually surveilling American citizens. Yeah, you remember that guy, right? Well, that guy fled through Russia to try to get to Ecuador, where he tried to reach asylum. However, when he got to Russia, he was redirected. The Russian intelligence agents offered to assist him to return in return for any and all secrets he knew. Now, Edward actually wants you to know that he refused, and he continues to refuse to give up his information. Now, as he quoted, "I didn't cooperate with the eight Russian intelligence services. I haven't, and I won't." He says, "I destroyed my access to the archive, and I have no material with me before I left Hong Kong because I knew it was going to go through this complex multi-jurisdictional route." Now, Snowden spent 40 days in Moscow airport trying to negotiate asylum in various countries. After being denied asylum of 27 nations, he settled in Russia, where he remains today. Now, his view, and quoted saying that, "People look at me now as if I'm a crazy guy, I'm this extremist or whatever. Some people have a misconception that I set out to burn down the NSA," he says, "but that's not what this is all about. In many ways, 2013 wasn't about surveillance at all." What it was about was the violation of the Constitution. Now, Snowden's ultimate goal is to eventually return to the United States. However, he has even tried to make deals with different administrations who want him to come actually face trial. Now, however, he has one condition. He has to be able to tell the jury why he did what he did, and the jury has to decide, was this justified or unjustified? Now, this is called public interest defense. It's allowed for pretty much every other type of crime out there that you can be charged for, even murder, for example. And it can be like self-defense, or it could be manslaughter instead of first-degree murder, so on and so forth. But in the case of telling a journalist the truth about how the government was breaking the law, the government says there can be no defense. There can be no justification for why you did it. The only thing the jury gets to consider is, did you tell a journalist something you were not allowed to tell him? And if yes, it doesn't matter. You go to jail. Now, it sounds like the only chance that Edward will have to come back is if the laws change so that the jury gets to decide if it was right or wrong to expose the government's own law-breaking. Only time will tell.
Hey, do you work from WeWork or know someone who does? Well, your data was probably visible. WeWork's weak Wi-Fi security has been leaving sensitive data accessible on its open network for years. That may have compromised both organizations that work in WeWork spaces and those that have never entered WeWork but do business with companies that use its offices. Reports from Fast Company and CNET have taken us into the critical issue of WeWork's oversight and implications for its customers. The findings come from Timo Iromo, who, according to CNET, evaluated WeWork's Wi-Fi security in 2015 before moving his digital media company into one of its Manhattan offices. He was able to view hundreds of other companies' financial records and devices on the building's network, and upon alerting the community manager, he found out that WeWork, well, they already knew about it. WeWork Wi-Fi is protected by a password, which CNET says appears in plain text on the WeWork app. Multiple WeWorks in New York and some in California share that same password. Now, Iromo has continued to run regular Wi-Fi scans on the WeWork network, scans that show 658 devices exposed in an astronomical amount of data, including financial records, business transactions, client databases, emails from other companies, driver's license and passport scans, job applications, contracts, lawsuits, banking credentials, and, oh, by the way, health data.
Ow. That was horrible. Anyway, it doesn't get any better with my blip. Hackers have found a new way to amplify the crippling effects of denial-of-service techniques by abusing an improperly implemented tool found in almost 1 million network-connected cameras, DVRs, and other Internet of Things devices. The technique abuses WS Discovery, a protocol that a wide array of network devices use to automatically connect to one another. Often abbreviated as WSD, the protocol lets devices send user datagram protocol packets that describe the device capabilities and requirements over port 3702. Devices that receive the probes can respond with replies that can be tens to hundreds of times bigger. WSD was shipped with Windows since Vista and is one of the ways the operating system automatically finds network-based printers. The WD specification calls for probes and responses to be restricted to local networks, but over the past few months, researchers and attackers have started to realize that many Internet of Things devices allow other devices to send probes and responses over the internet at large. The result, these improperly designed devices have become a vehicle capable of converting modest amounts of malicious bandwidth into crippling torrents that take down websites. Depending on the service, responses can be anywhere from 7 to 153 times bigger, an amplification that puts WSD among the most powerful techniques for amplifying distributed denial-of-service attacks. Research with content delivery network Akamai were recently in the process of investigating WSD amplification when a customer in the gaming industry was hit with just such an attack. At its peak, it generated 35 gigabits per second of junk traffic. That's nowhere close to record-setting attacks of 620 gigabits in 2016 and 1.7 terabits last year. Still, the new amplification method is concerning, in part because the pool of available devices, which Akamai estimates is more than 802,000 in number, is so large. Sigh. This is why we can't have nice things. UPnP was also created with the best of intentions, but it seems WSD will now join UPnP as poster children for abused protocols meant to help make the Internet of Things easier to use and set up.
Now, AT&T customers are not happy with their service provider sharing their location data, especially the bounty hunters. Now, in fact, some customers have gone so far as a class action suit against the company. Now, they are not just happy campers, really. However, AT&T says, too bad for you guys. When you sign up for service, you sign a contract. That contract forces you to resolve issues only as far as arbitration or privately, and you can't take them to court. Now, this takes us back to our discussion we had with consumers about having trouble holding services accountable for their data and security privacy. Now, AT&T is obviously abusing access to their data, including selling it to people without authorizing or credentials to handle it, but there's not much consumers can do here other than to stop using AT&T. Now, according to AT&T, quote from the filing, each time they entered into a new wireless customer agreement with AT&T, they not only agree to AT&T's privacy policy, but also agree to resolve their disputes with AT&T, including the claims asserted in this action in arbitration on an individual basis. Now, when the plaintiffs or AT&T, who are the AT&T customers, accepted AT&T's terms and conditions when, say, purchasing a new phone, they also agree to specifically the arbitration clause. Now, the class action suit filed on behalf of AT&T customers came after multiple investigations into the sale and abuse of location data. Now, part of this was people being able to buy data from third-party bounty hunters after they acquired it from a source service called Microbit. Now, Microbit sold location information for T-Mobile, Sprint, and AT&T phones. Now, Microbit wasn't the only company. There was also Circare One, and it sold data for T-Mobile, AT&T, and Sprint to around 250 bounty hunter customers as well. Now, in response, all of the telco companies have actually stopped selling the data. Now, on top of that, multiple lawyers filed class action lawsuits over the sale of the phone location data, including the EFF. Now, they are being blocked because of all this. Now, general courts usually uphold the application of mandatory arbitration clauses in consumer contracts, precluding litigation in court, and typically also precluding any form of group proceedings in arbitration. What does this mean for customers or organizations using these services? Well, one, before you enter in a service contract, determine if you can opt out of the arbitration clause. That's number one. And of course, second, carefully consider whether you should be using the service if you don't agree with their policies. That means it might be time for you to start reading the fine print.
Well, GitHub is growing up. It just bought Simly and became a CVE numbering authority. GitHub, which as everyone knows is a popular code repository, is becoming a CVE numbering authority and acquiring Simly, a code analysis engine that will be available to all public repositories and enterprise customers. Now, as a CVE numbering authority, GitHub can assign a CVE ID, post to the CVE list, and then post to the National Vulnerability Database on behalf of a developer. According to a blog post announcing its news, GitHub said it expects the combination of Simly code scanning and CVE number assignment will make it much more likely that vulnerabilities in open source projects will be found and reported. Simly, for its part, reports that more than 100 open source CVEs have already been identified using its semantic code analysis system. And for GitHub, well, as of August, it hosted its 100 millionth repository.
So, millions of Americans' medical images and data are available on the Internet. Medical images and health data belong to millions of Americans, including x-rays, MRIs, CT scans, and etc., are sitting unprotected on the Internet and available to anyone with basic computer expertise. The records cover more than 5 million patients in the United States and millions more around the world. In some cases, a snoop could use free software programs or just a typical web browser to view the images and private data, according to an investigation by ProPublica and a German broadcaster. And I'm not going to try and pronounce his name, but it's a good German name. Anyway, They identified 187 servers, computers that are used to store and retrieve medical data in the U.S. They were unprotected by passwords or even basic security precautions. The computer systems from Florida to California are used in doctors' offices, medical imaging centers, and mobile X-ray services. The insecure servers they uncovered added to a growing list of medical record systems that have been compromised in recent years. Unlike some of the more infamous recent security breaches in which hackers circumvented a company's cyber defenses, these records were often stored on servers that lacked security precautions that long ago became standard for businesses and government agencies. It's not even hacking, they say. It's walking into an open door, according to Jackie Singh, a cybersecurity researcher and chief executive of the consulting firm Spyglass Security. Some medical providers started locking down their systems after we told them of what we found. Anyway, the story goes on to list other servers found containing medical information and, in general, a rogues list of medical organizations that have ignored even basic cybersecurity. My commentary on this is that we have far too many Luddites using technology to produce sensitive personal information, and that doctors need to get much more serious about these data stores. Perhaps they need to take a page from their own rule book on protecting access to pharmaceutical information.
Thanks, Chibert. Well, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that is DigitalOcean. Now, as a developer, I can tell you that the ability to experiment and put your apps in an environment to actually test things out is hard. It's really hard to deploy. It's hard to get up on a hosted service. It's really hard to innovate when you have to worry about all the logistics. Well, DigitalOcean removes all the impedance. It gets rid of the complexity of cloud deployments and hosting. They make it easy for you than ever to actually deploy your applications and your code and store things on the cloud without all the steps in between. Now, I also love the names they give things, starting with DigitalOcean's Droplets, which are actually super scalable virtual machines that you can add on storage, security, and monitoring capabilities with just one click of a button. They also have really great one-click deployment models that you can actually make easy to bootstrap projects, like, for instance, specific distributions of Linux, one-click deploy Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, and more. And how about a one-click deploy of an application or application stack? Well, they add Docker, LAMP, MongoDB, Node.js, MySQL, and more with just one click of a button. Not only is it easy to deploy, it's easy to manage as well. VM snapshots are super simple to take and manage. For me, it gives me peace of mind that last known good state is always one click away. Plus, team management and unifying collaboration helps you kind of your teams manage and scale your infrastructure as you need it. You need more security? Well, they also have one-click ads firewalls as well for your Droplet and your Droplet groups. Now get this, cloud firewalls are free. And don't let that free kind of fool you. These firewalls are not just for your low-tier systems or testing environments or staging environments, and they're production-ready firewalls that can scale with your business. Now, DigitalOcean is trusted by over 1 million developers. They make it simple to launch in the cloud and to scale as you grow, whether you're running on a virtual machine or 10,000 virtual machines. Spin up a virtual machine in just 55 seconds. Standard, general purpose, or CPU optimized configurations provide flexibility to build, test, and grow your application. Now, to meet the demands of the market, DigitalOcean follows a really great pricing model. It's predictable pricing. You always know what you're going to pay with monthly caps and flat pricing across all the data centers. No more complexity when it comes to actually understanding your future bills or paying your current ones. Is your site starting to become popular? You need to scale? Well, they have load balancers also, as well as highly available, fully managed services. They're easy to add with just one click to add to your Droplets. Easy peasy. Now, if you're like me, you want to write scripts and manage things with using code, well, DigitalOcean had you covered. As an API guy, I can tell you they have really great APIs, standard HTTP requests to just deploy and manage thousands of Droplets resources in a simple programmatic way. Now, there's tons of reasons why you should consider DigitalOcean, even some of the extra stuff that they don't actually charge you for. For instance, 24/7, 365 world-class support. Really great support, monitoring and alerts, 99.9% uptime SLA. They have team accounts, full DNS management, 12 global data centers and more. If you ask me, DigitalOcean has you covered on all fronts. Now, there's no reason why you shouldn't go and try DigitalOcean right now, especially to support This Week in Enterprise Tech. Go to do.co/twit, especially if you're just thinking about doing a project in the future. Just go try it right now, because over 150,000 businesses, including some of the world's fastest growing startups, rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. DigitalOcean is on a mission to simplify cloud computing so developers and their teams can spend more time building software that changes the world. Go to do.co/twit today to sign up and receive a $50 credit. That's do.co/twit for a free $50 credit. DigitalOcean, designed for developers, built for businesses. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, let's go ahead and jump into the bites. We have actually quite a bit of them today. Starting with this one, Google is really known for their internet search dominance and, of course, a large chunk of digital advertising market as well. Well, however, some states and a coalition of actual attorney general representing 50 of the U.S. states and territories have put it into perspective that they actually believe Google's dominance is not fair. Why? Well, because there's no way to have a free market or competition increasing prices at will. They believe that if you're increasingly giving over your privacy information for free without control, it's not really free, right? Well, Google's attorneys are extremely familiar with handling antitrust probes by now. They are confident they will continue to answer questions about privacy no matter which country asks them. Google is accustomed to antitrust probes, and after several past present investigations and actions against them, they've prevailed. But the internet giant so far isn't the only major business facing serious complaints. Now, Facebook also has confirmed that they are under antitrust investigations by the FTC. And last week, a coalition of attorneys general representing 8 states and District of Columbia also launched a probe. Now, Congress in June launched a bipartisan investigation looking at competition in digital markets. The investigation, which includes probing Facebook, Google, Amazon so far, but it's been drawn out. Okay. Now, we know, I mean, obviously these types of companies, they have pretty prominent services. They have lots of traffic going to them. Cheever, what's going on? What do you think? Is this a witch hunt? Are they trying to basically go back to the days of, we've talked about, you know, Bell Systems being broken up? Is it basically very the same thing?
Yeah, I think so. I saw what's happening now is almost identical to what I saw when Ma Bell got broken up. Now, I'm not saying the breakup of the Bell system was good or bad. It just happened. It did create some new markets, but it also made doing certain things a lot harder. The reality is when you have a medium, in this case, I'm going to talk about the internet in just more of a generic term. When you have a medium that reaches worldwide without, you know, having any kind of, you know, clue towards national boundaries, when a product or a service becomes really huge and popular, it starts looking like a monopoly because it has such huge reach. In the days of Ma Bell, you know, reaching across state lines meant someone had to spend a whole lot of money to go and actually run physical lines and things like that. You had to hire people. So on one hand, yeah, this is kind of a witch hunt because this is how internet services and things just grow. On the other hand, though, yeah, Google, because they're so big, they're, in my opinion, there seems to be just a shade of arrogance involved. They are the 5,000-pound gorilla, and they know it. So you know, maybe, just maybe, something like this, you know, the FTC and Department of Justice, even if this doesn't succeed, it certainly does send an interesting message that, hey, if you're going to be an internet giant, maybe, just maybe, you might want to go and consider just a smidgen of humility in the way you do business, and don't go crushing your competition with sticks of dynamite and sledgehammers.
That's right. Yeah, I think the interesting thing here is obviously their internet centered around search. You know, Google's obviously dominating the market here. but they also have the browser, right? They're dominating the browser market as well, which you use to surf the rest of the web. So whether you're not searching, you're also browsing the rest of the web. So you kind of have, you're using all Google technology here, even without searching. I want to throw this to Kurt. Kurt, does this claim hold water? Because now they own not only search, they own most of the advertising. They also pretty much own the data that you use to surf the rest of the web. Is this something that is actually going to hold water as we move forward?
Well, it might. And, you know, I think the interesting thing is not just that they dominate search. That's one thing. But if we look back at other antitrust and anti-competitive actions in the past, they've tended to revolve around companies that linked technology or linked services in multiple areas. I can think of a notable case where there were a lot of questions about a company that linked operating system and browser. There have been cases around companies that linked hardware sales and service contracts. And when each of those becomes dominant in its segment, that's when the attorneys general tend to get really interested. In Google's case, not only do they dominate the search part of the internet, they do have a significant, if not overwhelming, share of the browser market. So that's two. They've got all of this data that they're selling in terms of the advertising. That's three. They have also been successful with the operating system when it comes to both Android and Chrome OS. That's four. You start adding up all of those things, and it does create a very significant bar to real competition. You know, Google is going to come in and say that when they started, of course, they were way behind AltaVista. But life has moved. Life has changed. The markets have changed. And I think right now, Google is in a position of having succeeded at so many things that there are some very legitimate questions that can be asked. And I suspect some non-trivial agreements that will be reached in the fullness of time.
Agreed. You actually bring up a bunch of good points here. Obviously, they pretty much dominate in every layer. Right? You talk about operating system, you talk about browser, you talk about search, you talk about advertising. Chibert, I want to throw this to you. Is it time we just succumb to the fact that we're stuck? There's no way for us to be private on the internet, and we should just deal with it.
Yeah, maybe. You know, it's starting to feel like. Yes, maybe, and just maybe, Google needs to have some separate operating pieces, shall we say. Having people within Google being able to link hands and control things to such an extent that they've had a really, really free rein on how they manipulate a lot of very private data for us. You know, having, say, for instance, my home address is not necessarily a huge piece of privacy, but when you start linking it with services, what kinds of things I search for, things like that, when you start adding them all up, that's when it starts getting really interesting on how bound we are, how much of our lives are out there on the internet. And it does give me the heebie-jeebies when you have one single corporation linking hands across multiple divisions and combining that data to create a very, very complete view of what I would consider my private life. So the other thing that kind of worries me is, you know, are they going to start price fixing? You know, when you start having one corporation controlling so much of the internet market, you know, they're all going to, you know, march to the same drum. And if that starts controlling the cost of doing business, that's kind of a worry to me. Anyway, right. I've been up on a soapbox. You know, I think it's time for, you know, it's Kurt's turn. Kurt.
Yeah. Yeah, Kurt, I wanted to throw this to you, get your thought on this as well, because as Cheever said, you know, they're controlling a lot of area, a surface area here. But we've heard this story before, right? Obviously, Apple has this story. They own search, but they have this story where they own the OS. They own iOS, Android. I'm sorry, iOS, Mac OS. They obviously own the browser market here too as well, which is pretty good in Safari. You know, Microsoft did the same thing, right? So the question is Google any different here? Is it just meaning that, hey, we should just succumb and say that, hey, privacy's out the door?
Well, I think that Google is different because of the scope of their success. I mean, look at Apple, and the iPhone is very successful, and therefore iOS is successful. But the Macintosh, while it has been successful as a single brand of computer, it was never more than, you know, single digits in terms of percentage of the overall OS market. Google's been very successful. And, you know, Brian mentioned perhaps time to make sure that Google was operating as different companies. Let's remember, they have taken steps in that direction. We keep referring to Google as a company. Google's not a company. The company is Alphabet. Google is a service, is a subsidiary, if you will, of Alphabet. So I think the people who manage the company once known as Google have been trying to prepare the enterprise for something like this. You know, we have Google, Alphabet, which has Google, which has its various research firms, which has things like Nest, which has all different sorts of things. They could very easily parcel those out and separate them by greater or lesser extents. And it would not surprise me in the slightest to see some of that going on in the fairly near future as a way to try to head off some of these legal challenges, especially if they start looking like the legal challenges are becoming more coordinated and therefore a little bit more likely to succeed.
Makes sense. What do you think, Cheebert? Is this something that we have to worry about? Is this are they going to be more successful here?
Actually, what I'm going to do is I'm going to, just as an exercise, I'm going to flip the coin and take a good hard look back. Google and now Alphabet, actually, as a large corporation, actually has also done a heck of a lot of good for the internet community in general. I remember internet email accounts actually costing lots of money. I remember having to pay something upwards of, oh geez, I think my CompuServe account was up to about $30 a month. And so one of the nice things is, you know, if I need a temporary email account to do some testing, or if I need to have a email account just to do something, anything, you know, kids baseball team, I can spin one up for free. And that's been something very different. Cloud storage. So playing a little bit of devil's advocate, as Lou says, Google has lit a fire under a lot of internet technologies and has driven the cost down. So looking at the other side of the coin, having a corporation this big and can afford to take risks on brand new technology has done the world a heck of a lot of good. There's an awful lot of schools that, strictly from a cost standpoint, has gone to Chromebooks, has gone to the Google Apps. And I've been using them a lot. You know, we use them for coordinating the Twilight Show. And they work pretty well. And it's kind of cool to be able to work, you know, halfway around the world, Kurt and I can work on documents together. We can work on spreadsheets together and actually see the changes being made live. That's kind of a big deal, and that hasn't been available for too terribly long. And I'm not sure if it actually showed up first from Google, but having it available so widely has certainly changed the face of cooperative work across the internet. What do you guys think?
I agree. I definitely think that they have changed the face. They've been able to move it forward. They create this level of competition that adds, you know, a level of competition for other organizations to kind of move their services forward. Microsoft seeing that, especially you talk a little bit about using Google Sheets and documents. Obviously, Microsoft is fighting back with Word and Excel. So I definitely think it's kind of forcing the competition needle. But Kurt, before we move on to your bite and jump into the next ad, I do want to kind of throw it to you last and give you a hypothetical. Now, this sounds a little familiar, right? Let's just say a company came along, they offered really dirt cheap, high performance content hosting, right? Maybe including books and movies. Now they're able to essentially dominate the market. They have 80% of all the web and their hosting services there. Now, what if they use the data that came off of their infrastructure to make more money, to offer more services even cheaper, and to dominate the market even more? Does that sound similar to you, to this target? What do you think? Is it maybe better to then maybe not be number one and fly under the radar, or is it just a kind of a target rich environment?
Well, I think it is something of a target rich environment, and I'm not going to say that it's ever better to be number two. I think in this case, what is really starting to get to people is the degree to which companies like Google, and Google and Facebook are the two poster children for this, the extent to which they have information that they use in ways that people aren't aware that they agreed to. Now, if you look at the user agreements, in almost all cases, they did in fact say that the company could use their data more or less any way they choose. But most people didn't think about it. And I think the degree to which they feel icky about data use varies person to person, but almost all of us do have a point at which we go, you know, that just feels wrong. And I think more and more people are reaching that point when it comes to Google. They're letting the law enforcement people in their state, the attorneys general and consumer protection people in their states, know about it. And with a major election cycle coming up in about a year, you better believe this is going to get attention from those elected officials.
Absolutely. Well, folks, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about security and crowdsourcing. But before we get to all that, let's go ahead and thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Worldwide Technology. Now, if you ever get a chance to visit the Worldwide Technology's Advanced Technology Center, you should definitely go because it's a truly amazing site. They began building it 10 years ago, and it's really grown exponentially. It's really like no other testing and research lab you've ever seen. Now, listen to what the lab contains. More than $500 million in equipment from hundreds of OEMs and key partners ranging from heavyweights like NetApp, Cisco, and VMware to emerging disruptors like Tanium, Equinix, and Expanse. Now, you want to go work with your organization that you can trust, right? Well, WWT is a trusted partner who stays with you over the years. In fact, many of their customers have been with them for over a decade because they know WWT is where they can go to get the answers they need to make sure their business runs right. Now, with all of it has to offer, the ATC really is an incubator for innovation, IT innovation. Listen to the what else it has to offer. It has on-demand, schedulable labs like NetApp Cloud Volumes, ONTAP on Flash, NetApp Disaster Recovery as a Service, along with hundreds of their other labs representing newest advances in Flash technology, multi-cloud, hyper-converged infrastructure, cloud data management, and more. Now, you've worked with lots of large projects before, and you know, well, sometimes you just want to try to build something and have a proof of concept before you know if what the industry has to offer to help you build it. Well, ATC can help you learn about products before you launch. WWT's engineers use these environments to quickly spin up proof of concepts and pilots using the sandboxes so that customers can confidently select the best solutions. In many cases, this actually reduces concept to time from months to weeks, which increases your speed to market. They also offer lab as a service. Now, it's a dedicated lab space within the ATC. Here, the customers actually perform programmatic testing, including using their vast technology system that WWT has already built. Now, it's virtual. You can take full advantage of the unique benefits anywhere in the world 24/7. Now, WWT's engineers work in these labs every day, beta testing new equipment and building reference architectures and custom integrations to help customers make decisions and see results faster and much less time and investment. Now, many people have been eagerly waiting. The time is finally here. WWT has launched their new digital platform encompassing the ATC ecosystem. Now, this ecosystem creates a multiplier effect of knowledge, speed, and agility. Anytime, anywhere around the world for their customers, get access to articles, case studies, hands-on labs, and other tools that make the difference in today's fast-paced world. To learn more about WWT, the ATC, and sign up for access to their new on-demand lab platform, go to WWT.com/twit. WWT simplifies the complex. That's WWT.com/twit. WWT, delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. And we thank Worldwide Technologies for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, Kirk, I'm going to throw it over to you. We'll talk a little bit about crowdsourcing and security.
Yeah, you know, crowdsourcing and the gig economy have been in the news a lot lately as people look at how much those who are driving for companies like Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash actually make. So let's look at that in a slightly different context. Let's say you have offensive security skills. You're a red team researcher. You want to use those skills for some gainful employment. You go to a job interview. You listen to all the benefits. And here's what they have to tell you. Well, you have to understand, most of the time, you'll work for free. Unless you actually find a vulnerability, and we might or might not pay you for that eventually. We offer no paid sick days, no holidays, no days off of any kind because, you know, those will just be those free days we talked about. The tools you want to use for your job? You mean like the laptop, the mobile, the Wi-Fi pineapple, all of the various bits and pieces of your red team kit? Well, those are all on you, of course. Pension, retirement, that's what Social Security's for, right? Or an IRA. We highly recommend an IRA. And that's really it. Everything else you can think of, well, that's what we don't provide either. Now, if you heard that, you would say, I'd be crazy to take a job offer like that. But for thousands of security researchers, that's the reality. They are the ultimate contractors. They are the ultimate individual workers because they're out there doing the research, looking for the vulnerabilities, looking for exploits for those vulnerabilities, and then pitching them at various bounty programs that companies run. I mentioned some of the other gig economy companies earlier in this piece, but it's not really a direct one-to-one relation between the types of jobs. Because if you go to work for, let's say, Uber, they may not pay you a lot for every ride, but they will pay you for every ride. Same is true for Lyft and the others. Gig economy workers tend to be paid for their labor. Security researchers, not so much. And those bounties that we talked about, now there have been some very highly publicized large bounties, well into six figures. But those are few and far between. The fact is that most bounties paid for bounty programs average about $5,000. And it really does take a lot of work. In my job, I talk to a lot of researchers. I see the rigs they put together. I hear about the time that they put into finding these vulnerabilities. And it's incredible. As an example, I mean, there's a very good reason why, if you look at most of the speculative execution side channel attacks or side channel vulnerabilities that we've heard about recently, you know, after the original Spectre and Meltdown, the vast majority have come from universities. Why? Because they take incredible amounts of time to find, incredible amounts of effort to find, and universities have a resource that most of us don't. They have graduate students. Graduate students, they want to get a master's thesis or doctoral dissertation out of it, and so they will quite literally work for free or even less. In many cases, they're paying for the privilege. Yeah, most companies can't get away with that. So the companies in the industry have a lot of work to do. Now, they may have teams that are dedicated to what they call researcher success, customer success. The fact is that they are still depending upon these independent researchers to find critical problems in their code, in their systems, and they're not paying them, at least not on a consistent, knowable basis. And it doesn't do any good to say, well, if those researchers aren't out there looking for the problems, we'll be safe, because the bad guys, the malware writers, the criminal agencies, the state-sponsored criminal agencies, they have a lot of incentive to find these vulnerabilities, to find these exploits. And they will go in and devote whatever resources they have to getting it done. So what are we going to do? I mean, the companies that are paying these bug bounties are fairly ruthless about the groups of researchers they have in there. Most people don't know that you often have to be invited to be part of one of these paid bug bounty programs. And if you don't submit bugs or potential bugs on a fairly regular basis, you get dropped. So it's like you lose the claim to that particular piece of digital dirt where you could go panning for gold. We're seeing more and more companies do a form of gamification. I've talked to several of these where you treat it like a game. You open it wide and get a lot of people throwing their effort into it. And if they submit real vulnerabilities, well, they get points, they get dollars, they get rewards of various sorts. Ultimately, though, what companies are fighting is a mismatch in the number of skilled employees and the number of positions they're willing to pay for. And until they figure that out, we're going to have this ragtag system populated, I have to say, by very intelligent, very creative, very hardworking people. But there has to be a better way. It's just that no one so far has figured it out. So, Lou, I want to come to you. Can you imagine the kind of system that we have for bug hunting working for software development? I mean, can you imagine trying to manage a team doing a major application where you said, I want you to submit code for free, and if I use it, I might pay you, but if not, well, go back and write something else. How well do you think that would work for creating quality commercial applications?
So I'd say one thing companies and people in the companies would start flocking to different parts of the industry, because I don't think that is a scalable model for sure. There are plenty of times where we write code and we run code coverage tools to find out, oh, wait, our code isn't even called. It's not even used. Maybe we should just get rid of this dead code. Or it's not even useful. And I think that definitely happens a lot. And I can definitely tell you that developers would be very frustrated to know, oh, well, I guess you decided not to use my code or somebody else's code instead, and now I don't get paid. So I definitely think that's not a scalable model. As Cheebert and I were talking in the back channel here, it's interesting. I think companies are losing out on a great opportunity here. You have all of these researchers. You have potentially even the evildoers that are willing to submit vulnerabilities and issues with your software and your services, and you pay them just a little bit, a fraction of the money that you could potentially lose by having these things become public. And you do it ahead of time before they actually do become public, and you get the chance to actually cover it up, basically, right? Think about it. And now they're not really running the programs really well. They're not offering the money they used to. They're not choosing the ones that are even just the smaller vulnerabilities. I think they're kind of creating this exclusive club out of it. And I think that, if they kind of just take a step back, take a pause, reboot, and start over, pardon the pun, like just start the service, start the system over and start doing it again, I guarantee that it could scale. Like it definitely can scale. It could turn the bad guys into good guys. It can keep them away. I just think that it could be a great scalable model, and they're just not taking advantage of it.
Well, Cheebert, I do want to turn to you, and you do work at one of the universities. You've seen how the whole graduate student system works for research. Do you see that as an ongoing model for great security research, or do you agree with Lou that really what's needed is for these companies to step up and offer a better financial model to the people who are out there finding the vulnerabilities in their products?
There are an awful lot of grad students. The grad students and postdocs and so forth, they're getting compensated. They're getting compensated with a grade. They're getting compensated with university credits. So they're not working for free technically. And, my whole attitude about this bug bounty program is that corporations are treating this as a hobby. They're expecting talented hobbyists to basically work for free. So say, for instance, a bug takes you, let's call it a couple hundred hours to find, and your bug bounty is $5,000. Divide that up and, we're not making a whole lot of money. So where's the incentive? All you're really giving them is bragging rights. One thought, I don't think it's a perfect solution, but one thought is, with the cost of software nowadays, your people that are going to be looking for bugs in your software are typically people that use your software. They are people that you typically are paying for that software. So say, for instance, I find a bug in, say, SAP HANA. Let's go shoot for the moon here. A bug bounty of $5,000 for a bug in something that major, I feel would be almost an insult. What I'd rather do is I'd rather say, hey, SAP, I found you a bug that potentially is going to save you hundreds or thousands of dollars, maybe even millions of dollars, because your customers aren't going to get pissed off at you and things like that. I would rather have a hobbyist license. Reward me with a hobbyist license. If I sign up for the program and I'm willing to go and help you find bugs, maybe you give me a copy of SAP HANA. Maybe it doesn't have an unlimited connection license. Maybe it only has a 5 connection license, but it's a fully functional version of SAP HANA so that I can go and tinker. I'd say encourage the hobbyists. Make it so that they can feed their hobby, but still reward them somehow. And, with the price of software nowadays, that's not an insignificant reward. What do you think, Lou?
I, I agree. I definitely think, you know, having these rewards that are basically based off of the severity of the find definitely could help. It definitely can to make things not only more interesting, but it also will bring the quality in. I think, you know, the more that these researchers and these people find and try at things, they're going to find the big ones and they're going to get rewarded for how big they are. And I think there are some programs out there. I have seen, I can't remember if it's Apple's or Microsoft's, that says, hey, depending on the size of this thing, and the amount of impact it has, we will reward you accordingly. But again, as Kurt said, we don't know if these things are being paid out. We don't know how valuable and how fast they are to respond. And I think that's causing the problem.
Well, this is the kind of thing that we're going to be talking about for a long time to come, because the model is going to be evolving for a long time to come. If you're a researcher, you have great interest in seeing this fixed. And to be honest, if you use software, you have a great interest in seeing this be gotten right. I look forward to continuing to cover it and to come back to the Twyatt Riot at a future time when someone does, in fact, put a better idea into practice. And that does it for my bite. Lou, back to you to lead us forward through Twyatt.
Thanks, Kurt. Well, we have one more bite to go, but before we get to that, we have to think of another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is LastPass. Now, it's one of my favorite tools in the world. I love LastPass. In fact, I use it so often, I don't even know I use it anymore. It's one of my favorite tools. Think about it. You have a username and password for every site you go to, every site, especially the ones you find most important. For instance, your financial sites, your business sites, your social networks, your emails, you name it. For me, it's 5 different banks. I'm supposed to remember a username and password for every one of those sites. It becomes impossible to manage. And you don't want to write those passwords down on sticky notes because people will find them. Plus, you don't want to put it in your email because it's just a bad idea to put it in plain text. Well, that's where LastPass comes in and saves us all. It automatically remembers and fills your passwords anytime, anywhere, whether you're on your computer or your mobile device. All you have to do is remember your master password. And LastPass remembers the rest. Now, I got hooked on it on using it on my desktop, but it also became useful on all of my devices everywhere. In fact, they have really great browser add-ins that help you support Chrome, Edge, Firefox, Opera, and more. Plus, they work great on Android and iOS, so use it on your device as well. What it adds a peace of mind here, that your data is encrypted and decrypted at the device level. That means that data is stored in a vault. It's kept secret even from LastPass. Now, I remember one day my family called me and they said, oh my gosh, we got to pay this bill. We have to make a payment. We can't access the account. Do you remember the password? Of course not. I didn't remember it. So what did I do? I just went and jumped in and logged into my LastPass vault. I remembered my master password and bam, I could give them the password and they were able to make the payment. It saved me time, saved me money. It was easy. Now, I'm talking about my personal account use here, but LastPass offers LastPass families. Of course, they offer and a loss all enterprise system as well. They recently expanded their business lineup with some amazing features to improve security across your company to make life easier for users. Now listen to this. LastPass Enterprise includes single sign-in for 1,200 plus SAML integrated apps, and each with its getting started guide, so it's simple to get up and running. Now LastPass also offers MFA, and it leverages your biometrics like your face and or fingerprint and contextual factors like location or IP address to know where you are, who you say you are. Now LastPass Identity is a combination of LPE and LPMFA, from single sign-on and password management to adapter authentication. LastPass gives granular control to IT frictionless access, all in one simple, secure solution. LastPass makes it easy to use unique random passwords that your employees don't have to remember or write down. In fact, huge point here, get this. They also have Active Directory integration. Now think about that. You no longer have to have numerous accounts, numerous passwords. You only have to remember your AD password, and LastPass will get you signed in. One password to rule them all. It literally will help you and your organization. But get this, they don't only store passwords for you too. You can store important documents, passports, driver's licenses. You can also store anything in your digital copy vault. You can use your passport option to upload a photo, and everything will be accessible in just a few easy clicks. Now, online shopping can get even easier. All your payment card information can be accessed from an easier checkout process, all without opening your wallet. Honestly, I love LastPass. They keep expanding their functionality and capabilities, and I just keep having to use it every day. Protect yourself and your business with LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager, trusted by over 43,000 businesses. Twit uses LastPass Enterprise, and we are excited about all the new products. From authentication to access to passwords, LastPass manages every entry point to your business so you can mitigate risk while improving employee productivity. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. That's LastPass.com/twit. We thank LastPass for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, Chibert, I do want to throw it to you for the last bite here if we have time.
Yeah, I want to make a comment. Since going to LastPass, the pro version, I have dramatically increased the strength of my passwords and the complexity. So it's actually made a pretty big difference in, securing my resources and things like that. Now, one of the resources I secure is my VPN, and that's what this story is about. So hackers are actively unleashing attacks that attempt to steal encryption keys, passwords, and other sensitive data from servers that have failed to apply critical fixes for two widely used virtual private network products, according to some researchers. The vulnerabilities can be exploited by sending unpatched servers certain web requests that contain a special sequence of characters, according to researchers at the Black Hat Security Conference in Las Vegas couple months ago. The pre-authorization file reading vulnerabilities resided in the FortiGate SSL VPN, installed about 480,000 servers, and the competing Pulse Secure SSL VPN installed about 50,000 machines, according to researchers from DevCore Security Consulting. The DevCore researchers discovered that other critical vulnerabilities in both products. These make possible for attackers to, among other things, remotely execute malicious code and change passwords. Patches for the FortiGate VPN became available in May and in April for Pulse Secure. But installing the patches can often cause service disruptions that prevent businesses from carrying out essential tasks. So they went further and did some internet scans over that particular weekend, and they found some interesting things. So the Security Intelligence Service bad packets show there are 14,528 Pulse Secure VPN endpoints vulnerable to that particular flaw and being exploited. And it's up from a previous 2,658 unpatched servers. The vulnerable servers were found in 121 countries. Anyway, some of the scans were at places like U.S. military, federal, state, and local government agencies, public universities and schools, hospitals and health care providers, major financial institutions, and several Fortune 500 companies. So, obviously, the message to this is patch, patch, for God's sakes, please patch. But you know what? VPNs aren't really a magic bullet. They're only as secure as the software they reside on. So one of the things that we want to kind of bring up is how many of us use VPNs? How many of us have a trust in the VPN that maybe is unfounded? So open question to Lou and Kurt. How many of the VPNs that you've worked with make it difficult to patch because when you patch or update, it breaks something? How often have you had to fight with your VPN? Let's throw it to Lou first. You obviously work at Microsoft, so you know about VPNs. What kinds of frustrations have you had with VPNs?
Well, to be clear, I don't use VPN from the corporate network, just to make sure that's clear. But I do use VPNs. I use IPV, IP Vanish, and Go and Hide My Ass too. As I've used them both, and I can tell you that I do see what I see normally a lot is I do see servers disappear. They detect your latency and then they go and connect for you, or you can choose a server. And I can tell you that this, the dynamic list of servers that show up in there they just disappear. And I can tell by even looking at the versions of the services that are on those servers when they show up in the list, they kind of fluctuate. And so I think some of the services have this system down pretty well, where they figured out a way to actually enable patching and enable updating, pulling it out of service, putting it back in when it's ready. But again, it is kind of annoying because, like, for instance, Seattle will disappear and then I'll have to connect to like Phoenix or Colorado or something. And so I definitely get higher latency. And so it is something that I have complained to some of them before to say, hey, you know, I'm not getting the performance or the latency I expect. And, you know, it'd be great if you guys would keep these things in service over time. So I definitely think it is a problem. And, you know, I don't think that they couldn't do it, though. There's got to be ways to be able to patch these things without service disruption, but I don't think all of them have figured it out yet.
Yeah, there's been a lot of frustration. I actually fell into the buy an unlimited lifetime VPN and it's gone. Shucks. Anyway, one of the things the article does talk about is Fortinet, and that's actually a piece of hardware with, you know, obviously firmware on it. So we're talking about an SSL VPN into your corporate network. Now, one of the things that I have found that is more than just a little disturbing is too many people treat SSL VPNs as a magic bullet, but they go and drop the traffic directly into the trusted zone on behind their firewall. And it's like, oh, excuse me, are you putting too much trust? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to throw this at Kurt, in that we have been saying over and over and over again, perimeter security is dead, should stay dead, do not become a zombie. But how are corporations really listening? So I'm going to put Kurt on the spot and ask, do you think the corporations that you've dealt with, are they really listening? Are they finally putting the nail in the coffin for perimeter security?
No. And the reason they're not is legal liability more than anything. They've got to be able to – can you imagine what would happen if a large enterprise decided to go full in on the sort of defense, the multi-layer defense that concentrates on limiting the ability of an attacker to do anything useful once they're inside the network and just gives up on having things like firewalls. The first time they had any sort of breach at all, and let's be clear, they would eventually have a breach, they would be sued within an inch of their life. So perimeter security remains a topic, but for the intelligent enterprises, it is one of the layers in a multi-layer security posture. And it is a layer where the assumption is that it will be breached. It will slow people down. It will get rid of people who aren't serious, but it's going to be breached. And I think that in many cases, the VPN is similar to that. I mean, I still encourage everyone to use a VPN if they are communicating from any sort of public place. If you're, you know, working from a coffee house, if you're working from the local library, if you're working from a truck stop, you know, wherever it may be, if you're connecting to the network at your school, by all means, use a VPN, but don't turn your brain off when you turn your VPN on. So continue to look for other things. Continue to be smart about which links you follow. Continue to be smart about which attachments you'll open in email. Be smart, keep all the layers going, and know that the VPN is an important component, but it's a component that is as fallible as any other component in your security infrastructure.
I think that Kurt should be paid for that one. Don't turn your brain off. That's a great marketing ploy for VPNs.
Oh, I like that too. Yeah. Actually, that actually sounds like a great show title. Don't turn your brain off. Anyway, we can go on and on and on about VPNs. They need to be treated as a tool. Use the tool correctly, you know, tune it up. You know, if you use a dull chisel, that chisel is more than likely to go and put a gash in your hand. You know, treat your chisels well. Treat your tools well. Maintain them correctly. Patch, for God's sakes, please patch. Please update. You know, the tools get old. They get rusty. You know, same thing with your software. Anyway, we've had a lot of fun. I think it's time to hand this back to Lou, and maybe it's time to say goodbye.
Thanks, Cheever. Yeah, absolutely. You've done it again, folks. You've sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast, according to 9 out of 10 security bug bounties and their payouts. But I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host in crime. I wouldn't want to do this show without them. They make it the show that it is, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, where can the folks find you and all of your work?
Well, Lou, people can find me and my work at Dark Reading, darkreading.com, and especially the Edge section. Now, with that said, I've got a piece that actually will go live tomorrow at Dark Reading on VPNs. Some of the ways that VPNs can and have let us down. If you've been listening to the show this far, there are at least a couple of the items in my article that won't be any big surprise to you, but there will be others that I think you'll gain some knowledge if you follow it. So head over tomorrow as you're drinking your weekend cup of coffee and take a look at that. Next week, I've got some interesting stuff coming up, including a child's garden of DDoS attacks at the Edge. So lots going on. I'm having fun. I'll have some conferences I'll be attending later in the fall, things like Gartner. So some big happenings. As always, follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA. Let me know if you're going to be at one of these shows. Would love to meet IRL with the Twilight Riot at one of these conferences.
Thanks, Kurt. We also have to thank our geek in paradise, Mr. Brian G. Chiebert. Where can the folks find you and all of your work, and how can they get in touch with you about show topics?
Well, hey, I'm on Twitter at ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, or you're more than welcome to drop me an email at chiebert@twit.tv, but better yet, why don't you use twit@twit.tv, and that hits all the hosts. Love to hear your show ideas. I am booking like a madman trying to do things. I do want to say we didn't have a guest today because they had a family emergency, and I hope everything's okay. Family always has to come first, right, guys?
Absolutely. No Thank question. You, Cheever. Great. And they should hit you up on twit@twit.tv.
Yeah, there you go.
Fantastic. All right, great. Well, thanks, Cheever. Well, folks, we have to thank you as well. You continue to drop in each and every week to watch and to listen and to get your enterprise goodness for the week. And we want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to the show. You go to the show page right now, twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, our show notes, information about our guests, all the links to the topics we do during the show, as well as, more importantly, next to those videos, you actually get those helpful download to subscribe links and all those little badges there. You can choose the application of your choice to subscribe and listen to the podcast. It's really the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news and definitely support the show. So after you subscribe, share the show with your friends, your family, your coworkers. And remember, we love doing Twiat. We could do it by you supporting us. Also, remember, we love doing this show live as well each and every week, 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays. We do that at live.twit.tv. And if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room live too as well. They have some really great characters in there that continually asking us questions, changing the direction of the show. And that would be at irc.twit.tv. twit.tv. We love the chat room, and we really get some really great topics in there. Also, don't forget you can follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. You get to see what I do during my normal daily work week at Microsoft. Plus, I get to post all my projects that I do there. Now, if you want to see what else I do here at Microsoft, go to dev.office.com where you can see all the latest and greatest ways to customize your Office experience. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week. We love doing this show, and we couldn't do the show without them. Also, I want to thank everyone at Twit who makes this show possible, especially the engineers. Of course, we have to thank our producer as well, Mr. Brian Chi. He does all the bookings, the plannings, and of course, we couldn't do this show without him. And of course, before we sign out, we have to thank our TD for today, Victor. Victor, you were doing a lot of work for us today. I know we were doing muting problems back and forth. Thank you so much for helping us out. But of course, we have to continue the tradition for today. What was the major topic of the show?
I'm not really sure. I had my brain off for the last hour.
Well done, sir. Well done. I would say that we just maybe need a little bit of search and service diversity, but you were really close. Maybe next time, Victor.
Well, okay. I'll try to leave my brain on at the beginning of the show.
Sounds good. Sounds good. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.